Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Nomi Prince and Ira Harris. Nomi has worked on Wall Street as a managing director at Goldman Sachs and ran the International Analytics Group as a senior managing director at Bear Stearns in London before becoming an author. Now a journalist, public speaker, and media commentator, she is the author of 6 books. Her writing has been featured in the New York Times, Forbes, Fortune, The Guardian, and The Nation, among others. Ira is an independent trader, successful hedge fund manager, global macro consultant trading foreign currencies, bonds, commodities, and equities for over 40 years. He was also CME director from 1997 to 2003. Welcome, Nomi and Ira.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Richard.
Well, Nomi is coming out with a new book on to be released on May 1st. It's titled Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World. She focuses on 5 areas, Mexico, Brazil, China, Japan, and Europe. And she's actually scoured the world to write this, visiting Mexico City, Guadalajara, Monterrey, Rio de Janeiro, Sao Paulo, Brasilia, Porto Alegre, Beijing, Shanghai, Tokyo, London, Berlin, and other cities throughout the United States. So that's a lot of traveling.
Sounded like a lot of traveling when you said it, Richard.
Yeah.
Yes, that happened.
So is that how it came about? Was it through these travels that you gained this insight? And how did you get this insight also through your work?
The insight itself, yes, it came from traveling on the ground, and that was a result of really watching what's happened since the financial crisis in terms of what the Federal Reserve has done and what other major central banks have done that we know about publicly in terms of advocating and creating and manifesting a cheap money policy, as well as a quantitative easing or asset purchasing policy. It's asset purchasing of bonds in the U.S., it's ETFs in Japan, it's corporate bonds in Europe, but effectively a collaborative process that really had different effects for the major countries versus the more developing countries. And also, even as it was coming about in the wake of the financial crisis, had a lot of worries and criticisms being brought up about it. And so what I wanted to do is discover how those worries and criticisms and impacts on more of the developing countries were part of the results of the Federal Reserve, ECB, Bank of Japan process of this particular policy. And so it was a combination of seeing what was going on and wanting to feel it and examine it and research it from the levels of those countries.
And is this collusion more of a handoff of a baton, for example, between central banks, or is it actually central banks that are more in close coordination with each other?
Right. So the main central banks that coordinated in the wake of the financial crisis, and even before it became public knowledge in the fall of 2008, this was going on in the beginning of 2007 and throughout 2007, is that they worked together to, for example, have a lot of dollars in the market in the central bank reserve system to be available in the case of a crisis. So they kind of knew in advance what could be happening. But to the public, of course, in particular, the Federal Reserve did this through Ben Bernanke. The face was, we've got this, there's no housing crisis, nothing bad's going to happen, everything's fine. In reality, central banks, the major ones, the G7 ones, were already starting to work together to mitigate any potential liquidity or money crisis that could result from any financial implosion. So that was already going on. But then once the financial crisis was in sort of full mode in the fall of 2008 and the spring of 2009, those conversations became much more frequent. The types of coordinated policies amongst these banks became more frequent. The amounts of them became more epic in terms of what was swapped between central banks, like I'll give you dollars, you give me euros and so forth throughout the process to create a sort of global tranquility on the outside that was really fabricated by these central banks. And then as the years went on, different types of timing periods were used to sort of catalyze this type of collusion or collaboration again. For example, in 2012, when there was a more pronounced credit crisis in Europe and so forth. And it goes on to this day. If the Fed raises rates a bit and it hampers the stock markets and all of a sudden there's a lot of chaos or turbulence, then the European Central Bank, as it just did, will step up and say, you know, we're not touching our rates. Our rates are good, low where they are. We're going to continue with our quantitative easing or our corporate buying process, so don't worry. So that's where the global collusion comes. And, of course, if you're outside of the sort of main group of these central banks, you're either acting with them or against them, depending on what you need to do for the domestic situation in your own country. For example, Brazil, when it had high inflation, had to do sort of different maneuvers relative to what the Fed was doing, but that also hurt it politically. And so a lot of different pulls and tugs came in the developed countries throughout this whole process.
And Ira, have you seen similar behavior between the central banks from your observations?
What are you throwing fuel on my fire? I'm listening, you know, and I'm going, okay. How do I know? I mean, you know, Richard, you know, we've known each other 3 or 4 years, but I've been discussing this with Santelli and blogging for years. And Nomi, I mean, can I just ask you a question? Are you familiar with Bernard Connolly?
I'm not. It sounds like I should be.
You ought to be. Yes. If you'll give Richard, I'll send you. Well, we'll talk about it later, but we have Bernard Connolly, who was at AIG London, went on podium, but he's far more than that. He wrote a book called The Rotten Heart of Europe, written in 1995.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Everything that has happened. Because he was on the original group that put together the euro currency. So what he saw behind the scenes is so similar with what you're discussing. I've come to call him a good friend. We talk. He's kind of disappeared now for a while, but he just needed a rest, I think. I can't wait to read your book. But Richard, you know that answer. The central banks have, as I would say, you know, what's going on in Europe especially. And we saw with Draghi this morning, that press conference was one of the greatest acts of prestidigitation I've seen since David Copperfield. He can dance it. But, I mean, you could see it in Europe. Draghi has taken – there's basically been a coup d'etat in which the ECB is running monetary and fiscal policy. He can't escape it. And therefore, they are all in this. And tonight, well, of course, we'll hear from Kuroda. Not that there'll be any change, especially with the political problems of Prime Minister Abe. So there's no question. It's such a strong word. I'm not used to hearing the word collusion. And it's interesting that you use that word. I always shy away from it because if I can't prove a conspiracy, then I lose some of my credibility. So I don't like, but I love that you do use that word because I do think it is that. And it makes me ask you the question, Nomi, right back to you, is, do you have some thoughts on the G30?
I do. And just to maybe circle back to the word, and I think that's a really good point to bring up because, I mean, I also shy away in my research and everything I talk about from the idea of conspiracy, because to me, even though it has lots of different definitions, the implied definition is that it's something done in sort of a dark corner, you know, to other outside groups, and therefore it's not out in the light. And to me, all of this has been pretty public. It's just that nobody's really, or a few people, you have, of course, but few people have connected the dots. So the term collusion, and of course it's used now constantly with respect to, you know, sort of the U.S. and Russia and the U.S. elections and Trump and Putin, whatever might or might not be going on with that, it's become a constant word in the vernacular, and so it's come to take upon itself one meaning. I think the collusion, the coordination, the collaboration, and it's parts of all of those things amongst the major central banks, definitely, if not intentionally being negative, definitely was a way of artificially creating a veneer in the financial markets and for the banking systems throughout the world, in particular the largest private banks that are codependent upon each other and upon, you know, the liquidity that central banks provide them and look to them as they did in the crisis and continually for support, that this sort of manipulation of markets by this huge outside fabricated source of capital really does fall under the definition of collusion, because it was done in concert, and because the perception around what central banks want their behavior to be and the actuality of how artificial it has been for the financial community and markets are at odds with each other.
Yeah, I think, yeah. Sorry, Richard, but I think that's absolutely perfect. Yeah, and let me just add one piece to that puzzle. That this colluding group is absolutely at odds with the BIS in so yes. many ways. I mean, we can go back to Bill White's work. I have it sitting on my desk, his work on the lean and clean and how the BIS has taken a different view. And actually, 2 years ago, I went to see Jaime Coruna speak in Chicago, and I asked him point blank a question, because being that his role with the Bank of España, and I said, now that you're at the BIS, what's your view on the zero risk weighting of all sovereign debt? I said, I understood what you believed when you were at the Bank of Spain, but it has your views changed? And he turned bright red and said, yeah, that's really a good question. Yes, I have a different opinion of it. And I thought it so clarified the things that you're exactly talking about, that it's this group is totally at odds with what the BIS has put forth, and they're supposed to be the banker's banker.
Right, and the BIS, as you know, has had a lot of reports out on this, as well as statements that the sort of collusive fabrication of money and the sort of cheaper negative interest rates on the major global economies has had a very negative effect on sort of the rest of the world. It's had the effect of raising wealth inequality. It's had, you know, by raising equity prices and infusing more debt into the world, which at some point will need to be paid off. And because equity prices and other asset prices have risen, that people who don't have the same access to them as sort of the wealthier classes and the participants in those markets get left behind. So they borrow more money in order to, you know, sort of keep themselves afloat. And so then their debt burdens are higher, but they're not participating in the upside of quantitative easing policy and so forth. So it creates these chasms for citizens within each of the countries, and as well as between countries amongst the world. And what I find so the most egregious at odds thing, to use your term, is that, for example, the Federal Reserve, all three of the sort of past chairs, from Ben Bernanke, who started it, to Janet Yellen, to currently Jerome Powell, just do not see any problem in what they've done. Same thing with the Bank of England. They'll note that inequality has risen, but they'll say, well, you know, inequality, you know, it rises for lots of different factors. Now, who can say it's because of, you know, this massively accommodative monetary policy we've just imposed for the last 10 years? And it's like, but the numbers say it. But you know, these individuals, Mario Draghi, as you mentioned, they don't see that. They put words around their actions that indicate they're doing this for the greater good. And the main economy and GDP and all sorts of other things. But in reality, this money goes to the main participants in the asset markets, and it has the effect of raising those prices and making certain things look really rosy and positive, and it doesn't go into the main economy. It can't. It is tied up on the books of these central banks. So how can it possibly go into the main economy?
Richard, are you going to get some? Because because if this comes, nobody's point is so perfect. You know, if we go back to Jackson Hole 2010 when Bernanke, you know, laid out what he was going to do with this, you know, portfolio balance channel, that's exactly what it was about. And you could see it in real time. And yet people said, no, and I would, you know, tongue in cheek ask, how is this different than trickle down economics? I mean, I'm following this through. We're not even going to get trickle down because there's no capital expenditure coming out of this. This is truly just asset price inflation, and who controls and owns the assets? Pretty easy. And then, of course, we get Tomas Piketty, you know, which his book basically was written in by Bernanke in Jackson Hole.
Yeah. And I mean, can we delve into some examples, Nomi, like from your book on like these areas, Europe, Japan, China, Brazil, Mexico? Can we go into some of the details that you've provided in the book?
Yeah, I mean, so for example, Mexico, which has other issues right now, as does Canada with the United States, relative to trade agreement conversations, had this issue in the beginning of the financial crisis, which was that its economy was doing pretty well. It really was having decent actual growth and actual development and sort of a decent amount of multiple forms of foreign investment and so forth. And you know, it's not like wages were perfect, but there was a sense of balance to an extent in the few years before the financial crisis hit. Then all of a sudden you have the U.S. banking system going, you know, crazy on toxic assets and fraud and crime and imploding the entire system and this reaction from the Fed and so forth. And at the time, Ortiz, who was the head of the central bank in Mexico, said, you know what, I've seen this play out in 1994 with the peso crisis, that there's sort of, you know, an external movement, there's a crisis, you know, the currency gets crushed. Certain companies, you know, that are contingent on sort of trade between various borders get hurt. They fire people. The economy suffers, and so forth. And he actually went up to Washington and had a meeting with Ben Bernanke. A meeting that isn't in Ben Bernanke's memoirs at all, but was covered by the Wall Street Journal. And he said, you know, you really need to do something to instill confidence in general. Not within the banking system, but from the banking system that's just done all this outward into the main citizenry, because otherwise, you know, these ramifications are going to have very long tail effects. And Bernanke sort of ignored him and didn't write about him and so forth. And Ortiz goes back and he tries to create a policy at the central bank level where he's critical of what's going on in the United States in terms of what they're doing with rates, in terms of them not restraining the banks that have just caused all of this chaos. And as a result, he doesn't get renominated to the post of being a central bank leader. It's taken over by Augustin Carstens, who has this sort of persona outside of Mexico of being more a part of this sort of elite group of central bankers and therefore able to sort of play ball with them. And then sort of Ortiz goes around the world, in particular to U.S. universities and so forth in talks and tries to warn people that these methods are going to ultimately create problems. In particular, he's concerned about regulating the banking system and the derivatives at the heart of the financial crisis going forward, because he felt, and it's true, that regulators like these central banks aren't watching them, which has been true. It is true, and it continues, and looks like with the current set of appointees into the Fed and what's going on around the world will continue to be true. So Carstens comes along. He tries to basically keep rates to an extent higher in Mexico. They have to be anyway. It's more of an emerging country, but not really follow the policies, even though he has friends in Washington, that the Fed's been doing, and kind of keep rates, even though he's dropping them, you know, as high as he possibly can to ward off inflationary problems like food prices and so forth that are going on in Mexico. They're going on in Brazil and throughout Latin and Central America. And as a result, he ultimately does come to odds with his leadership there and with the United States and ultimately with President Trump and sort of the crew that came in. And now he's at a senior position at the BIS, which, you know, as we've just pointed out before, has a sort of more realistic view of you know, sort of artificial fabrication of capital just for the financial markets and banks versus really caring about the ramifications for the real economy. So this was a whole, you know, decade of a trajectory through these leaders, these two main leaders. Now there's another, but two main leaders at the time of the central bank in Mexico that really tried to both keep their independence and also in different ways, there were different people, critique the Fed. And one sort of got kicked out and is doing other things. One is at the BIS, where again there's more of an ability to say what he thinks. And so that's the kind of thing that's happened. Meanwhile, in Mexico, there were a lot of problems because of our financial crisis in terms of their economy. And now there's other problems related to trade agreements and so forth. But that's really started with our financial crisis this time around.
So, Richard, can I pick up here?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I love this conversation. This is, wow, it's like meeting at Starbucks. let me ask you something. So now, and I have a reason for asking, I'm not going to tell you right now, but tell me where you fit the IMF into this colluding process.
So this is interesting because the IMF now under Christine Lagarde, I think, has a more is more similar to the BIS critique of this full process. In fact, I was at the Fed. I was at a conference at the Fed in the summer of 2015. They do an annual conference of the IMF, the Fed, and the World Bank regulators, the main regulators in those instances. They're regulatory bodies, but the main people that are in charge of regulation at central banks. And I spoke about this very topic, why the money that has been offered to the financial system hasn't made its way down into the Main Street arena for real. And my very quick summary of my talk was that I got up in front of them and I said, well, because you didn't make that money. You had no stipulations on the money that was given as to where it would or should go. As a result, why would you even be asking that question? But it was around the time, and Janet Yellen had spoken just before me in the room in front of me and had said that, you know, everything was fine. You know, we've passed regulations in the United States called Dodd-Frank under the Obama administration, and they basically had the effect of beating down the bank's most egregious risky practices, and everything was going to be fine. Now, without addressing anything that the Fed had done and was still doing to provide capital to these and to the asset markets. But after that, there was a luncheon. This is a long answer, but I just want to set the stage here. There was a luncheon at which Christine Lagarde was the speaker. And this was right after she was having a sort of public media battle with Janet Yellen about not raising rates yet. They hadn't yet. This was the summer of 2015, because it would negatively impact the emerging economies and countries that were going to be exposed to the dollar in too punitive a way. So they had borrowed money over these years because they had been at a disadvantage because they kept their rates and had to keep their rates higher to fight inflation and other things in their own countries relative to the main countries keeping money down for their financial system. So there was a sort of dislocation there, and all this debt has accumulated there. But if the dollar were to go up because rates were to go up, then all of their repayments that had to be done in dollars would be that much more expensive for corporations or for the governments in these emerging countries, and that would have a negative effect on those countries. So that's where she was coming from. Not that she was advocating quantitative easing, but what she was saying is, like, look, you've created this mess, and you have to understand what the ramifications will be. She didn't really come up with a solution as to how to do this in a better manner, but she certainly warned that the other side could be potentially really dangerous. What she also did was spend a lot of time working with the leader of the People's Bank of China, Zhao, who's not Governor Zhao, who's not there now. He's just been replaced, but he's just retired. But he had been a longstanding central bank leader, and actually he and her had a very good relationship. And one of the things that happened in the recent years is that the Chinese yuan, the currency, became part of the basket of currencies that the IMF has. And the reason for that is, I think, that the IMF is trying to find a way to diversify away from simply the sort of U.S.-centric, European-centric, Japan sort of ancillary contingent because of what has happened over the past decade and to sort of protect the world going forward. So I think this whole decade has seen a big shift in some of the allegiances of the IMF under her. I'm not sure where that will go in the future, but that seems to be what has happened.
I raised the issue because when they chose her, of course, you know, Dominique Strauss-Kahn got pushed out, and I actually had a letter published in the Financial Times suggesting that either Augustin Carstens, I know he was considered for that post, but of course he fell back into the overwhelm. But I thought that they should have taken Trevor Manuel from South Africa and elevated him because I thought he's probably one of the best finance ministers that we've seen. And it's time to elevate, as you rightly talk about, non-European, non-U.S. Yes, I know that it's their money basically making up the IMF, so that the money, when it's your gold, you get to make the golden rule. So, but it was time to make that shift. I'm not a Lagarde fan. I'm not an IMF fan either. I think that they have a very sordid history when it comes to certain things, and I'll always be appalled that they stepped in the Greek situation. I know I have a sense as to why that they stepped in, but they were just all wrong because if Greece is part of the EU and the EU is a developed nation with lots of assets, what is the IMF sticking their nose in there for? And I know the Chinese were not happy about it, as a lot of the people who work at the IMF at a higher level thought that that was a very bad decision. I think they're going to come and rue it, you know, after Lagarde's gone. And when this stuff all gets played out, it will have proven to be a very poor decision. But thank you for answering that.
What about Japan? Go ahead.
No, just yeah. This is a great conversation. I agree that there has to be, and that was one of the things I actually, you know, noted in China and in the China chapter in the book, is spending time with the heads of the New Development Bank and just, you know, the whole idea of even having sort of other consortiums, whether through trade alliances or sort of development bank alliances that have sort of other countries outside of the main ones that created the IMF and the World Bank and sort of, you know, control most of the reserve currencies in the world to basically have something else where they have that strength. And there's been a lot of growth that really doesn't get covered. I mean, I don't know what it's like over there, but it certainly doesn't get covered in the U.S., the extent to which developed countries, non sort of G7, more the outside parts of the G30 and beyond that, are actually working together to, to sort of be established in a different way and have more sort of power in the world economy.
It's a good point. I've suggested in my blog for the last 8-9 years that every time the IMF comes crying for more money, that they should just issue gold-backed bonds and take that hoard of gold that they sit on. It always bothers me when strict neo-Keynesians will not. It's just sitting there, and you can leverage it up. You know, you're from a banking background. I could take that gold and create over $1 trillion of bond that people around the world who would like a little hard currency or some sense of stability. If it was 20% backed by gold, the demand for it would be so great, and the borrowing cost. Don't come asking for more. You got plenty of money. Just put it to use. But go ahead.
Right.
I was just going to ask on Japan. You have a section in the book on Japan, Nomi, and what is the real story behind the Bank of Japan's quantitative and qualitative easing program, which began in 2013, augmented with a negative interest rate policy, for large-scale purchases of Japanese government bonds? You go into some detail on the real story behind such actions.
Yeah, so what was going on, of course, is Shinzo Abe, the current leader of Japan, was also having instilling upon Japan his Abe economics, and effectively that was an element of stimulus that he brought in, and he needed someone at the Bank of Japan that would sort of mirror that. with the kind of policies that the Fed was doing. I mean, the Bank of Japan had been involved in dropping rates along this whole period of time, but not, and in quantitative easing. In fact, they invented quantitative easing to an extent back in 2001, but they basically came on board when Kuroda, who's the current head of the Bank of Japan, was selected to lead it. And his philosophy was very much in keeping with the Fed's philosophy and in keeping with Abe's philosophy, that somehow if there was this like wash of capital made available by the bank, by the central bank, and it could go wherever it needed to go in the economy or in corporations, or in the case of the Bank of Japan, they actually buy ETFs or exchange traded funds, which are collections of basically stocks, and so therefore helps elevate the stock market in Japan, that this was going to create politically also a positive environment for people in Japan to look to, you know, this leader and say he's doing a great job for us. You know, Japan, of course, has had a very flat economic situation in terms of growth for a long time, and so this has been a way to, you know, consider it a stimulus both from a fiscal perspective and a monetary perspective. And even though technically central banks are supposed to I don't even know who said they were supposed to. There's legal, you know, sort of boundaries between a central bank and its government in certain countries, but the reality is that central banks, by virtue of being able to conduct these policies and impact the entire financial system of these countries, are not independent of governments. And so what Kuroda did was basically give Abe credibility and vice versa in sort of promoting two sets of policies that they could then spin as being positive for the country. There's also sort of a backstory to that, which is more relevant now in the sort of age of heightened trade wars. I think trade wars or trade reagreements have been happening very quickly throughout this decade. And of course, Japan just has a new agreement with Europe that was penciled not too long ago and so forth. But they're also trying to position themselves for those types of agreements and to have sort of more of a leadership role and not just sort of a shadow role to the U.S. in the global economy. And by having a central bank that can very liberally conduct these sort of monetary policy moves, it sort of helps their elevation with counterparts as well. They sort of have the capital to do things, and that's a benefit to their overall stature, which again is a benefit to Abe.
And the go ahead, Ira. Do you wanted to comment? Or?
No, I'm just. Yeah. Okay. Nomi, how do I not know you?
Because I travel so much. Yeah. We both travel so much. We're never
amazing.
In the same place at the same time.
Yeah. It's amazing because, I mean, these are things covered in the same way, too. You know, and Japan is a very good area for my son. He happens to be, he's fluent and literate in Japanese and covers Japan for the Taneo Group in out of Washington. So, I have him do my translations for stuff, and he's supposed to stay more in touch with me. But I've been trading for over 40 years. The Japanese have always interested me from a currency perspective. And what we've seen, and we can see it, if you go back to the IMF G20 communique in October of 2012, when the yen really begins its descent from 76, 77, 78 yen to the dollar to where we presently exist. I mean, that was done. You could read the communique because I actually wrote a blog on it. I can remember it, October 15th, 2012, because they got the nod and the wink from the IMF that it was okay for them to allow the currency to weaken. And right. They get more. I mean, that's when Abe first, you know, he reappears as the Democratic Party of Japan, who had a short run, got replaced again by the LDP, and it all begins to fit into place. So what we're seeing, we're going to see it tonight. And the bank, the BOJ is caught here. Now, they've been very lucky, and I use that word as we might use the word collude. They've been lucky. They've been very fortunate that the world has had enough growth to carry them. And anybody who compares Japan to the U.S., well, we're going to Japan. I don't think that's right, because Japan started from a different place anyway. They started with an enormous pool of savings when the whole stagnation period for over two decades has taken place. So they had savings to burn off. And number two, they had the great luck, I won't call that luck, but 97% of Japanese debt was owned by Japanese.
Right.
And if you're in a deflationary period, they're not being punished, they're being rewarded. So, I mean, we are speaking on the Financial Repression Authority podcast. So they weren't being financially repressed because of the deflationary cycle that Japan, they're not in it anymore. Now they're being financially repressed because interest rates are so low. There's no return on earnings. And, you know, now they're really being harmed. So how long they will be able to continue this is interesting. But I believe that Kuroda is a prisoner of this policy. He's a prisoner of his own success. And I have no idea how they're going to really make their way out of here.
No, I think that's right. That's probably why they've shifted. I mean, the one sort of modification he's made that the other central banks, well, the Swiss central bank has done, but is to buy stock, and that's very much because, you know, you've gone so low to negative on rates, and you do have such a sort of contained population and a better savings rate and all of that, just the philosophy of how they save and so forth. There's nowhere really else to go, as there is nowhere else to go in the rest of the world, but because of this particular situation in Japan, except into the Japanese stock market, which is also very highly owned by the Japanese. And so the central bank is kind of trying to, I think, push off some of the and again, this is politically motivated, but to push off some of the problems that could arise when, you know, this mass, this population of people that really don't invest outside of the country have nowhere else to go. And so they're kind of helping to pop up, you know, so the only game in town, which is their stock market. And that, I think, is a reason for the modification of quantitative easing relative to the Fed, that doesn't actually buy the stock market here. But what the Fed does is it supplies all of this cheap money and gives all of these green lights to the private banks, who then sort of lend it out to the corporations and so forth. And so they buy their own stock. I mean, we're looking at record levels of stock buybacks here. So here there's like a step removed, whereas there I think the central bank is more directly involved in the stock market.
They have QQE, not just QE.
Right.
And perhaps finally we can end with some examples on Europe. You have two chapters on that, Nomi, in the book, and a lot of interaction, battles between the European Central Bank and the German Bundesbank.
Right.
Angela Merkel as German Chancellor, Wolfgang Schäuble, German Finance Minister, and of course Draghi. Can you give some examples and insight on that?
Sure. So those chapters are actually, you know, before Draghi and after Draghi. So before he was head of the European Central Bank, when it was Jean-Claude Trichet, that was during the time where, Ira mentioned Greece before, where Greece was being sort of absolutely punished for having been involved in allowing foreign investment into Greece effectively, and then being punished because of the overall decline in the economy and the fact that these bondholders wanted their money back. And everyone from this European Central Bank to the Bundesbank, as you mentioned, to the IMF, to sort of anyone involved in Europe, thought it was a really good idea to punish Greece by providing a sort of quote bailout that really was an extraction of whatever wealth and asset values were left physically in Greece. And so that was kind of where that problem came in, and Mario Draghi came into that environment sort of promoting that, but also really advocating more quantitative easing to wash over everybody's issues and massively increase the balance sheet, the books of the European Central Bank through that process. I mean, he had very strong relationships also with the U.S. He had come from Goldman. He had been at the Bank of Italy, which was having a lot of problems. So his fortuitous timing of leaving the Bank of Italy to run the European Central Bank got him out of sort of that situation. As a result, not just of his move, but what was going on at the time, from Greece to Italy to, you know, Portugal, Spain, all of these countries were being hurt by this new wash of money that was going into the major banks, for example, in Germany. And so what's interesting is that even though a lot of the money that was made available through the European Central Bank to the, really the core countries and banks in Europe relative to the more, you know, sort of South and Eastern countries in Europe, as it happened, had the benefit of helping the part of the German banking system that was private. And at the same time, the Bundesbank, because it's getting this help, but it's also seeing that Germany is doing quite well from a growth perspective relative to all the rest of these sort of debt-ridden problematic countries. And so Germany's, relative to the rest of Europe, really enjoying, a strong benefit in general. So they do have some inflation. They do want, to reduce the reliance on quantitative easing, and they do have a fight that emerges between the Bundesbank and the European Central Bank, because the European Central Bank is now all of a sudden setting policy for all of Europe, and the Bundesbank is like, we don't really adhere to that because we think rates shouldn't be this low. We actually think they should be higher, and there is growth here, and there is inflation here, and our people are doing fine. And so there's been this constant fight, again, you know, between sort of Germany and the European Central Bank over monetary policy since Draghi's been there, and, you know, with Schäuble and so forth because of that. And so they have a very kind of different situation because they're fractured in that way. And then you throw into that England, and sort of the Brexit vote, which was a direct result of people, within the UK being, or the people that voted for Brexit being concerned about all of the mess that was going on in Europe, you know, blaming immigrants and blaming all sorts of other things rather than the policies of these sort of competing central banks who are ultimately helping their own banks relative to their own people. In England, that was just seen on a ground level. And Bank of England, of course, was doing the same policy within England, sort of, you know, quantitative easing, helping its markets and helping its banks while wages have been stagnant and so forth. So there's been a real fracture going on throughout Europe, which is manifested in how people vote in their economic anxieties and so forth.
Thoughts on that? I know you've written a lot on the blog site, Ira. Yeah.
First, let me, and this is my opinion, going back to 2011 when Draghi gets the nod, because that was Sarkozy besting Merkel. You know, when they put her on as the most influential person in Europe on Time Magazine, I broke into laughter. I was probably on a laughing for 2 days. There was no way the French were going to tolerate Axel Weber, who ought to have been the president of the ECB, because I think the Germans would have felt a lot more comfortable with a German at the helm. If you had to go down this path following the U.S., they'd be more comfortable. Draghi, no. Trichet, of course, goes back to when I lost a lot of money in the early 90s, thinking that they would break the after they broke the British pound link to the Deutschmark, that the French franc would be next, that they would have to let go of it. But people forget that Trichet was the head of the Bank of France at the time. And the Bank of France was raising overnight rates to stem the speculative tide to 100% for overnight borrowing, because in order to be short the French, you had to borrow them. So Trichet, as I would say, was more German than the Germans. And you saw it in 2011 when he raised his interest rates twice in the middle of this great financial crisis going on. Because that was him, I think, really placating the Germans at the time. And it was a grave mistake, which, of course, we get Draghi, but it ensured that France would never, never support a German at the helm. We're going to see the battle play out again right now, because this is going to be Wiedmann. I think the Germans are at the point, especially the politics in Germany are heating up, and everybody says, well, the, you know, AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland, was another immigration. You know, you know, Richard, and I, you know, I'll hear nobody speak this. It has more to do, in my mind, and I pay very close attention, that German savers, and Germans are savers. They have the lowest home ownership rate of any developed nation. It's like 42 or 43%. Germans don't traditionally borrow. They're savers. And there's been nobody more financially repressed than the German citizenry. And I think that gets brushed away too quickly as to what the rising sentiment is in Germany. And Merkel is phenomenally weakened. Even Macron can back her into a corner in different ways. But the rise of political angst in Germany is great. And I would argue vehemently that it has much more to do with the fact that inflation in Germany is, let's be kind and say, 2%, and they're running their full steam. And the savings, you know, the 2-year note in Germany right now is negative 55 basis points. So the people who are getting hung are German savers. And you're not seeing the rush of Germany. You know, the DAX is really well underperformed a lot of other markets, because after what happened in 2000, when they finally convinced German citizens to go into the Neuer market and the other stock markets, and then, of course, the dot-com bubble imploded and the German markets got especially hit hard, they've been reticent. So nobody has borne the brunt of ECB policy more than the German savers, and this is having great political ramifications.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I didn't even mention this, but I totally agree. I mean, they are concerned, and that's where the politicians that are rising in some of those areas are having sort of the most impact, you know, because you can't really save money on negative interest rates, and so that's another reason that they are at odds with the sort of ultra low rate policy of the European Central Bank.
Great. Well, I guess running out of time, but the book is Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World, new book by Nomi Prince. Yes. And I guess additionally above that, how can our listeners learn more about your work, Nomi?
Well, they're welcome to come to my website, which I try to update, which is www.nomiprince.com for anything that I might have new. I'll post you if I ever come out there. But also, yeah, just basically the book's available. I think it's on Amazon.ca and all sorts of different places. So,
yep. And Ira?
Well, I'm usually where I am, Richard. You can go to YRAHARIS.com. And when Notes from Underground, which is my blog, pops up, I can be reached there. You can subscribe to it for free. There's no advertising on it, nothing, just a lot of great dialectic that goes on between the readers over the serious issues. As you know, we have readership all over the world, so I hear from people who are boots on the ground when we tackle some of these. And I'm glad that we did this, because now I have to go search out Nomi Prince, and this is unbelievable. And I'm going to arrange to send her a copy of Bernard Connolly's book, because the fact that Bill Shepard and I printed 10,000 copies of him back in 2013 when the book was out of print. And Bernard actually wrote a new foreword for it in order for us to do that. So I have many books to spare. I think it's the most important book. No, I won't say that. Nobody's book is out now, and this is an important read for people who, you know, trade. You know, I'm a global macro trader. I've been doing this, and so I always bother to look through books of this nature, because you need to understand this. You need to, and these things don't end well. Not having read nobody's book, but I certainly will order it. I'm sure that's where it goes to, that they do not end well. It's not like this is new in history. I mean, it's been done before. And it's, in fact, the collusion, you know, I wanted to get to that, if I have a minute or two, that when nobody talks about that, central banks have really, they're going to lose their independence because they've overshot whatever mandates, their self-proclaimed mandates, I will say too, they're all self-proclaimed. Yeah, I know the U.S. Congress gave the Fed, but I'd argue that. But, you know, we're coming to a very great inflection point, as I blogged about the other day, Richard, that everybody better go dust off their knowledge about the 1951 accord between the Treasury and the Fed, when the Treasury forced the Fed prior to that to keep interest rates artificially low because of the huge amount of debt because of World War II, and then the Fed couldn't take it anymore after inflation got out of hand, and President Truman had to sit down and negotiate an accord. But we're coming to that. We're coming to this great inflection point because the Fed is now going to be trapped by this, because as interest rates start to rise, the cost of sustaining the U.S. debt is going to rise, and discretionary programs are going to have to be cut dramatically.
Yeah.
So here we come.
Wow, great insightful discussion based on history, financial perspectives, and economic perspectives. Thank you very much, Nomi and Ira.
Thank you so much.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.